51, and to tell the Conway Daily Sun that we may have been visited already, we don't know for sure. Robbie Mook, who had run Terry McAuliffe's campaign for governor in Virginia, would be Hillary's campaign manager. The Clintons figured that if the 35-year-old clean-shaven data whiz could get Terry, the original Clinton money man who'd founded a fly-by-night electric car company, elected the 72nd governor of Virginia, then he could get Hillary elected POTUS. Robbie introduced the 20 or so reporters crammed into Podesta's eat-in kitchen to the Brooklyn-based campaign team, right down to someone whose title was, I think, Assistant Deputy Director of Issues and Policy. Finally, at the end of the introductions, he threw up his hands and slapped his khaki thighs and said something like, "Oh yeah, and Huma, where's Huma?" Huma stood near a window overlooking the backyard. She gave an excruciating closed-mouth grin and waved four slim fingers at us. "Huma does the schedule and a lot of other things," Robbie said. In an instant, Robbie had reduced to an afterthought the most important force, whose last name wasn't Clinton, on the campaign and the person whom many of Hillary's friends would blame for her loss. Robbie didn't know at the time, he couldn't have, that the "a lot of other things" Huma would do included his own job. I'd been an insecure mess at the Podesta dinner. I was used to attending work parties with David Carr, who'd walk up to the most powerful person in the room and say, "Do you know my friend and colleague, Amy Chozick?" Always putting friend before colleague. In the weeks since he died, it had been hard to be in the newsroom. Editors tried to cheer me up. Dean started calling me Penguin. I didn't have the heart to tell him I was a polar bear. By the time I got to the spaghetti dinner, reporters had already thrown their messenger bags and reporters' notebooks over every seat at the main table in the dining room. I ended up at the kiddie table, a four-top fold-out like the one my dad set up for poker nights, squeezed into an adjacent den. Maggie Haberman sat in the center of the main table. She didn't have to work the room. Everyone came up to her. Maggie started at the Times the same day as David's funeral. Carolyn poaching her away from Politico was inspired. We all had whiplash refreshing our Twitter feeds trying to keep up with Maggie's reporting. I was excited to have her as a colleague, partly because you don't want to compete with Maggie, and partly because she was another badass woman to join our almost entirely male politics team. I wanted us to be friends. But the guys used her arrival as another way to get in my head. "Come on, you really think they'll keep you on the beat with Maggie there?" the guys would say. And when they didn't like the way I handled a sensitive story, they'd say, "Maggie would never do this to us." I later saw emails from Brown Loafer's guy instructing donors to talk to Maggie instead of me. Their antics didn't work. Maggie was a hardened pro and even less susceptible to the guy's bullshit than I was. But it was another attempt to undermine me and cast us on opposite sides of the steel cage match. I saw what happened to Anne. You've got a target on your back. In fact, the gathering was in part to signal that the era of original guy was over. Podesta and others called him a cancer, bantered that he was going off the rails, had been part of a goat rodeo at Hillary's State Department, and may or may not have a disorder. OG would still pull the strings from behind the scenes, but delicately, so reporters and even Hillary's own campaign staff would think he wasn't involved. Jennifer Palmieri, a grown-up who had held the top communications job in the Obama White House, would be Hillary's new communications director. With her deep-set hazel eyes and wispy blonde hair that softened her strict oblong jaw, Jen brought the cool breeze of sanity and grapefruit-scented bath salts to Hillary's press operation and helped me get over my phobia about the guys. We could make small talk about shopping and weight loss, our diets and Hillary's too. This included Hillary staring down a mouth-watering spread of barbecue picked up on a stop at the Whole Hog Cafe in Little Rock and putting a single tomato on her plate. Jen thought Brown Loafer's guy had potential if only we could beat the OG out of him. Outsider guy ended up leaving his position altogether, taking a lucrative Silicon Valley job. I moved the dickhead file to my archives and never again spoke to the guy whose support, sarcasm, and frequent sharing of dog photos initially made me believe I had some inside track. Feminine bonding aside, what set Jen up as antithetical to the guys was that while their comebacks to reporters were like those of a rapper seizing an open mic night, poetry and put-downs, is it possible to quote me yawning? Jen, the highest-ranking communications professional in Democratic politics, could hardly spit out a sentence. We had that in common, too. I'd listen to the audio of our conversations and transcribe quotes like, "It's, I just saw the president's, comments about it." And, like, "We have a plan," literally. I'd eventually see the sly genius in this potpourri of uhs and likes and ums peppered with eye rolls, confused squints, and a crooked smile. Jen gave us on-the-record access while rendering virtually every conversation unquotable. Making these pre-campaign receptions off the record didn't lead to candor. I almost spit out my marinara when Mandy Grunwald leaned in close to tell us Hillary would fight for every vote and take nothing for granted. During the expectation-setting portion of another off-the-record cocktail party, this one at Joel Benenson's Upper East Side apartment, the campaign assured me Hillary's announcement would encapsulate the mood of a nation. As they framed it, her message would be nothing short of poetry, similar in scale and scope to Clinton's forgotten middle class, with the historic heft of Obama promising from the steps of the old state capitol in Springfield, where Abraham Lincoln started his career, to end the smallness of our politics. Instead, we got a corporate catchphrase delivered in a cheery video that might as well have been a Pottery Barn ad. The video posted online on a Sunday afternoon in April. In classic Hillary fashion, she'd overcorrected from her 2008 announcement video when she'd been criticized for striking an all-about-me tone, telling supporters, "I'm in and I'm in to win," and sitting against a chintzy floral throw pillow. This time, Hillary handed her video over to a montage of carefully selected non-actors, a multicultural cross-section of the comfortably middle class. The black couple awaiting a first child, the earnest Asian-American college graduate applying for her first job, a gay couple strolling hand-in-hand talking about wedding planning, Latino brothers bursting with orgullo as they open a small business. Finally, 1 minute and 30 seconds into the roughly 2 minute video, Hillary appeared standing in the front yard of her Chappaqua home to say, "Everyday Americans need a champion, and I want to be that champion." It wasn't so much that the video was bad or did any damage. It was serviceable. It was safe. It was Hillary. But there was no meat on the bone. There was nothing for me or anyone else to grasp onto as, "That's why Hillary is running for president." The best historical analogy was to Edward M. Kennedy, the frontrunner ahead of the 1980 election, who'd been reduced to incoherence when CBS News' Roger Mudd asked him, "Why do you want to be president?" Depending on whom you asked, Hillary had spent the past 8 years or her entire life thinking about that question. Yet when she started her 2016 campaign, her only clear vision of the presidency seemed to be herself in it. Ever the eager student, Hillary spent the years since the State Department poring over academic papers and dense briefing books to re-educate herself about the country she hoped to lead. She'd consulted 200 policy advisors and grasped that sociologists and economists had concluded that Americans with annual household incomes of $35,000 to $100,000, the group any presidential candidate would need to win, no longer wanted to be called middle class. In the aftermath of the financial crisis, for the first time since the 1960s, the middle class no longer meant the house in the suburbs, the reliable job, the family trips to Disneyland. Middle now meant underwater mortgages, college debt for kids who wouldn't find jobs anyway, dwindling retirement savings, one diagnosis away from bankruptcy. Academics started using phrases like the near poor or the sandwich generation, and even revived a New Deal era term, the submerged middle class. But nobody was going to win the White House talking about the near poor or submerged voters. It made me think back to a conversation from a decade earlier. I'd worked at the Journal for less than a year when we all stood around discussing our plans for Thanksgiving. I said I was headed back to Texas. I loved Thanksgivings in Texas, which involved turkey picked up from the Rudy's barbecue inside a gas station and boxed cornbread and cherry-flavored jello mold. One of the senior journal editors said, "Texas, huh? Interesting. Be sure to check out a Walmart." As if the place we went to buy beach umbrellas and lawn chairs and paper tablecloths for backyard birthday parties was some bizarre retail concept and I was an anthropologist wading into the unknown. Texas, huh? That was how I envisioned Hillary's consultants when they sat in the conference room of her private office in Midtown Manhattan to contemplate what to call this curious specimen of 121 million Americans who who were technically middle class. Everyday Americans. It even sounded like Walmart's everyday low prices. The guys must have told me a dozen times that the road trip to Iowa had been Hillary's idea. "I'm hitting the road to earn your vote," she'd said in the video, and insisted they all hop in her pimped-out Scooby van for an incognito drive to Iowa. She always traveled with a portable radio so that she could listen to NPR until well into the primary when her staff showed her how to listen on an iPhone. The road trip included a stop at the Chipotle in a Toledo suburb where the chicken burrito bowl heard round the world. Hillary acted as if the vacuous political press had somehow heard about the burrito bowl and rushed to cover it. In reality, Brown Loafers guy, whose loafers and winning smile were making their way across the country alongside Hillary, tipped off a couple reporters. This led to the leak of the grainy security cam footage of Hillary and Huma behind dark glasses at the checkout line, Hillary carrying her own tray. As far as planned spontaneity went, the Chipotle stop was a coup. "Good spin on not being noticed," Brown Loafers wrote about the news coverage. Pundits took the Chipotle stop as a sign we'd get an all-new Hillary Unbound. "We've never seen her get a burrito before," Mark Halperin observed on Morning Joe. Hillary said she wanted to spend the early months of the campaign getting the input of everyday Americans. She took a cue from her 2000 Senate campaign in New York, when she'd embarked on a listening tour, sprinkling some First Lady stardust on upstate dairy farms and factory towns and bolstering her every woman appeal. Indeed, by the time she first ran for president in 2008, Hillary was a hands-on senator, constantly in touch with her upstate constituents. That was her frame of reference during the 08 primary when the press all crammed into a living room in a prefab home in a predominantly white suburb of Indiana to see Hillary sit at the kitchen table and listen for over an hour to a proud sheet metal worker's Local 20 member who'd lost his job. Or when I heard her tell an unemployed waitress on the rope line in Columbus to personally follow up with her about her hysterectomy. But by her second campaign, Hillary had spent 4 years traveling the world, meeting with the likes of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi and the Burmese opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi in Rangoon, a long way from Rochester. Hillary seemed like Rip Van Winkle, awoken after a 7-year slumber to find a vastly different country. She'd missed the rise of the Tea Party, she'd missed the Occupy Wall Street movement and the rage over health care and bank bailouts and the 1%. She was shocked when she heard about the opioid epidemic ravaging rural communities. "This kind of snuck up on us," she remarked in New Hampshire. And when she'd learned that people no longer wanted to be called middle class, a data point that seemed a fundamental shift in the American psyche and as clear a sign as any that there was something stirring this election year, Hillary and her consultants saw only a linguistic challenge. Perusing Hillary's paid speeches to Wall Street banks, Mandy Grunwald expressed her biggest concern. "The remarks below make it sound like HRC doesn't think the game is rigged, only that she recognizes that the public thinks so," she said. "They're angry. She isn't." No one called those early 2015 appearances a listening tour. That would have given too much credit to Mark Penn, who came up with the idea ahead of the 2000 Senate race. The events were always meticulously produced, giving them the feel of a Chuck Lorre soundstage. Hillary took her seat in the middle of a horseshoe-shaped table, or those one-sided tables only used by TV families and The Last Supper, surrounded by 7 or so voters, all with pre-screened stories to fit the day's theme: mental health, the heroin epidemic, small businesses, affordable childcare, and so forth. The campaign instructed the everyday Americans to call her Hillary rather than Madam Secretary. The backdrops included a packing plant outside Des Moines, where Hillary sat in front of neat boxes of fruits and vegetables labeled Made in the USA. In Columbia, South Carolina, she folded her hands under her chin for a chat with minority business owners at Kiki's Chicken and Waffles restaurant. Hillary would rattle off statistics she'd learned. The average 4-year graduate in Iowa graduates with nearly $30,000 in debt. And in New Hampshire, 96% of all businesses are considered small businesses. There was a lot of note-taking and little hugging, but Hillary loved to tell everyone how much she got out of these events. "I really like listening to people," she'd say. "I learn a lot. I like getting out and talking and figuring out what's on people's minds." She'd call her policy team and pass on little notes she'd jotted down, like telling them to start using opportunity system to refer to higher education, a term Hillary learned on a stop at Kirkwood Community College. When Bryce Smith, a 23-year-old bowling alley owner, told Hillary in Norwalk, Iowa, that his biggest challenge in starting a small business was his $40,000 in student loan debt hurting his access to credit, she lit up. I've never heard anyone so persuasively link the slowdown in business startups with college debt. Bryce got a handwritten thank you note, and Hillary delivered on her promise to visit his bowling alley in Adel before the caucuses. She did not bowl. The roundtables were entirely overrun by Hillary's staff and security detail and the press. It wasn't unusual to have a couple hundred reporters fighting for credentials to hear Hillary talk to half a dozen Iowans about community banking. Swedish, German, Japanese journalists all sprinted through rural Iowa when they spotted Hillary's van pulling up to a discussion about apprenticeship programs. By design, there was never enough space for the press. The pen and paper sat cross-legged or lay on our bellies on the cement factory floors. Cameras filled the space, and sound and lighting guys dangled their boom mics and bright bulbs over the voters' heads. This felt like a gross invasion at a children's furniture factory in Keene, New Hampshire, when a middle-aged factory worker, Pamela Livingood, broke down about her daughter's opioid addiction. "This little 5-year-old lives with me, and I'm guardian," she said. Hillary gave a knowing nod. "Pam, what you've just told me and what I'm hearing from a lot of different people, there is a hidden epidemic." When the talks wrapped up, Barb, the campaign photographer, would pose everyone for photos. Hillary gave voters the same pro tip every time. If you can see the camera can see you. That's when the press would shout questions. These were mostly variations on, "What about your emails?" bellowed by cable news anchors, but not always. During a discussion on small businesses at a craft brewery in Hampton, New Hampshire, a reporter yelled out, "Do you have a perception problem?" I'm going to let the American people decide that. After a talk about advanced manufacturing at a bike shop in Cedar Falls, Iowa, a correspondent for the Daily Mail yelled over and over as the half dozen or so Iowans sat dumbfounded, "Secretary, what makes you so special?" And again, the voice echoed over a question about community banking. "Secretary, what makes you so special?" A BuzzFeed headline read, "Two actual everyday Americans walk into a Hillary Clinton event and get crushed." The New York Magazine columnist Frank Rich called the roundtables worthy of a Christopher Guest parody. Chapter 14, The Everydays. He left behind a house in Mexico City that was neither poor nor rich, but thought itself better than both. Sandra Cisneros. Spring 2015. It didn't take long before the Hillary press corps turned everydays into a proper noun. When we needed to get past the barricades to talk to voters, it was, "Come on, my editors need me to quote some everydays." Or when a line of women snaked around outside Hillary's event at the Trident Technical College in North Charleston, we'd ask the campaign, "What's the crowd count on the everydays who couldn't get inside?" And when we had to identify the participants of Hillary's bite-sized talks about her plan for profit-sharing programs, we'd ask, "Do you have the names and titles for the everydays?" Even Brooklyn wasn't immune. When Chelsea requested a private plane to fly to an event, Podesta shrugged, "She's not an everyday American." But I never loved grammar more than in early May when we arrived at Rancho High School in North Las Vegas for a roundtable discussion on immigration. The plan was for Hillary to sit in the library in front of stacks of books and guides to the Dewey Decimal System and listen sympathetically as high-achieving students told her they feared their parents would be deported. The campaign's casting department had outdone itself. There was even a transgender daughter of undocumented immigrants. The night before, Annie Carney of Politico and I shared a mediocre platter of casino sushi. Bonding over our discovery that we went to the same exorbitant New York hair colorist, hers chestnut and wispy around her face, mine brown with honey-colored highlights that cost me a couple days' pay, we vowed to motivate each other to exercise on the road. In 2008, the campaign trail diet, combined with hours of sitting on a bus and my complete inability to get to a hotel gym, caused me to gain 20 pounds. To lose the weight before my impending wedding, I had to enlist in a boot camp taught by Iraq war vets. They made me sprint upstairs carrying car tires and yelled such motivational lines as, "Old people fuck faster than you run, Chozik!" I swore to myself I'd be more disciplined this time. From that trip on, Annie surpassed the situational trail friends that any campaign reporter must make in order to endure the long hours on the road and became an actual friend. We even spent time together when we had a rare day off the trail, drinking rosé on her Brooklyn rooftop with our very understanding husbands. That afternoon in Vegas, she gave me a ride to Rancho High School in her bright yellow Mustang rental. We walked in to find a troop of students hanging up blue parchment paper several times taller than they were. When they'd neatly affixed the welcome sign with white masking tape, we noticed the red letters that spelled out Hillary's campaign catchphrase, "Plus one glorious extraneous comma." "Every day, comma, Americans need a champion, and I want to be that champion." Hillary Clinton. It wasn't just 15-year-olds who could see the expression didn't make any sense. Hillary knew it wasn't working. "I know she has begun to hate everyday Americans," Podesta told the speechwriting team. "But if she doesn't say it once, people will notice and say we false started in Iowa." She complained to aides that the poll-tested lines they kept handing her were duds. What, she wondered, does "I want to make the middle class mean something again" mean? But Hillary wasn't sure what she wanted to say instead. So rather than casting the everydays to the annals of history, alongside Bob Dole's A Leader for America and John Kerry's Let America Be America Again, Hillary kept saying it and saying it. At one point, Jimmy Kimmel asked if she was jealous of Bernie's crisp "Feel the Burn" slogan, because "I've heard some of yours and they're not as good." Hillary brushed it off. "No, yeah, well, I've never been as good at slogans." But it was never about the slogan. It was about Hillary's inability to articulate why she wanted to be president. It was about Hillary, who'd been so in touch with struggling voters 8 years earlier, not being able to see that Americans had to be pretty pissed off to no longer want to be called middle class. Hillary often called herself a proud product of the American middle class and the daughter of a small businessman. I heard her tell the story about her father's drapery business so many times I could mouth the word "squeegee" at the exact second it came out of her mouth. "He went down with the silk screen and dumped the paint in and took the squeegee and kept going," she always said. She couldn't wait to drag that squeegee all over Trump. "I can only say that I'm certainly relieved that my late father never did business with you," she preened in the first debate. For the rest of the spring and into the summer, donors and prominent Democrats complained to the campaign about everyday Americans, even in one case raising the similarities to the Walmart slogan. Hillary told aides she felt as if she were wearing a straitjacket. In order to win over Obama's loyal voters, she needed to present herself as the center-left defender of his legacy. She said at almost every stop, and particularly with black audiences, "I don't think President Obama gets the credit he deserves." But Hillary also knew enough about politics to know that every election, no matter how popular the incumbent, needed to be about change. This led Brooklyn to joke that she should just borrow the slogan from the fictional fumbling Vice President Selina Meyer in HBO's Veep, who ran on a message of continuity with change. By August, the campaign started to slowly phase out the everydays. They tested 84 potential replacements. Theme: fairness families. A fair shot and a fair deal. Hillary for fairness for families. Building a fairer future today. Fairness worth the fight. Fairness first. Putting fairness first. A fair chance for families. A fair fight for families. You've earned a fair shot. You've earned a fair chance. A fair chance to get ahead. Families first. Building a fairer future. Fairness for all our families. Theme: fighter. Fighting for fairness. Fighting for you. She's got your back. Your family is her fight. Your family, her fight. Your future is her fight. Your future, her fight. A force for families. No quit. A fighting chance for families. Theme: basic bargain, making America work. Renewing America's promise. Renewing our basic bargain. A new promise for a new time. a better bargain for a better tomorrow. Get ahead, stay ahead. A better bargain for all. An America that works for you. An America built for you. A new bargain for a stronger America. Time for a better bargain. Putting America to work for you. Making America work for you. A promise you can count on. Theme, strength. Stronger together. A stronger tomorrow. Strength and fairness. Together we're strong. Strength you can count on. A stronger America working for you. The ideas we need and the strength to deliver. A stronger America for a new day. America's strength, America's promise. American strength for American families. Stronger at home. For an America that leads. America gets strong when you get ahead. A stronger America, one family at a time. Strength for all our families. Theme, results, count on. Real fairness, real solutions. New solutions, real results. A new bargain we can count on. Progress for the rest of us. Theme, in it together. Progress for people. Progress for all. Getting ahead together. Making America work together. Moving ahead together. Theme, future forward. Your future, your terms. Lifting us up, moving us forward. Building tomorrow's America. Building a better tomorrow. Our families, our future. Secure the future. A future worth fighting for. For your family, for America's future. Don't turn back. Keep moving. Move up. Rise up. Own the future. Go further. Move ahead. Climb higher. Unleash opportunity. Theme, it's about you. It's about you. It's about time. It's about time, and it's about you. It's about you because your time is now. It's your turn. Next begins with you. Brooklyn settled on fighting for us, breaking down barriers, and building ladders of opportunity. Hillary was lukewarm on fighting and barriers, but she loved the ladders. Months later, in the spin room after a Democratic debate, I performed the public service of telling her chief strategist, Joel Benenson, that the expression was a clunky garble of political talk. I could talk that way to Joel, a former New York reporter who had wisely cashed in but still liked to think of himself as a reporter. He loved to preface his regular ass-whippings of reporters with, "I understand, I used to be a reporter." And he'd warn the campaign, "The press will love writing these, I did when I was a reporter." One editor told me that Joel got into political consulting because the New York Times didn't hire him. I laughed at this as I walked into Benenson's Upper East Side apartment with its winding cylindrical staircase and floor-to-ceiling bookshelves. Joel was so confident in his status as an Obama campaign alum and Clinton outsider that he'd send notes around like, "We need a paradigm shift in how this world operates," referring to the old Clinton MO. But though Joel had some good ideas, he couldn't calibrate his neurotic irascibility to present them to Hillary with the delicacy required, as if transporting a Fabergé egg on the Amtrak. Early on, Huma decided Joel's personality wasn't a fit. And from then on, Hillary mostly ignored the strategic advice of her chief strategist. She did, however, offer Joel some of her own advice, telling him after the Iowa caucuses, "I've seen you on TV, you've got to remember to sit up straight." I preferred Joel's cocky combativeness to Podesta's removed nonchalance. Why can't she just promise to give people opportunities? Why the ladders of opportunity? What's with the ladders? I asked. Joel went from 0 to 90 in 2.5 seconds. "Well, clearly you've never needed a ladder." "I've needed ladders my whole life." He shook his bearded head at me. "I don't think so. I don't think you've ever needed a ladder or you're to understand." "Do you even know that I'm from Texas?" "That doesn't mean you needed ladders. I'm from Queens." "I've needed plenty of fucking ladders, Joel. I just don't get the line." And so on, until a journalism student, whom I have nothing but hope for, interrupted to ask me about internships at the Times. I gave him my card, turned back to Joel, who at this point was yelling, I think, at MSNBC's Casey Hunt, "What do you mean the youth vote? We're winning with voters over 30. I interrupted to say, "See, I just extended a ladder of opportunity." He laughed. Chapter 15. Fucking Democrats. Iowa, August 2015. Clear Lake has a population of 7,700 people and sits in Cerro Gordo County, a perfect square of farmland in the middle of northern Iowa, approximately 1,200 miles on either side from the ocean. I'd flown into Minneapolis and driven 3 hours to Clear Lake and was circling the parking lot outside the Surf Ballroom on a Friday afternoon in August. After covering the Iowa Democratic Wing Ding dinner, I had another 2-hour drive, a dull straight shot down I-35 to Des Moines. What Clear Lake lacks in geographic proximity to the ocean, it makes up for with its famous surf-themed dance hall. The ballroom, lined with plastic palm trees and built-in vinyl furniture and murals of beach scenes designed to give off the ambiance of a South Sea island, is frozen on the night of the winter dance party in February 1959 when Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and the Big Bopper gave their last performance before their single-engine Beechcraft Bonanza crashed into a frozen cornfield in nearby Mason City and killed everyone on board. The speeches weren't expected to start for at least another hour, and I wasn't in a hurry to get out of the car and be tempted by the signature baked chicken wings in Spicy and Mild. So I circled the parking lot a couple times, listening to the Don McLean song American Pie. That's when the Hummer backed into me. There was the quick sound of crushed aluminum, the smell of Italian salad dressing from my Subway salad as it flew off the passenger seat and exploded on impact with the floor mat. The seatbelt tugged at my chest so tight it nearly knocked the wind out of me. And then it was over. The Hummer inched forward. A man in his 40s with a goatee and broad shoulders that filled out his polo shirt stepped out of his hunk of expensive steel and testosterone. He had a pair of mirrored sunglasses perched on top of his baseball cap, and I could see the reflection of my banged-up car in them. He didn't apologize or ask if I was okay. He just slammed his car door, looked my way, and in the most visceral reminder of our divided politics, yelled, "Fucking Democrats!" Ever since high school, when my friend Kate shot the finger at a GMC pickup and the driver followed us to the Sonic and waved his shotgun at us, I knew better than to antagonize an angry man in an expensive truck. I calmly explained that I wasn't a Democrat. I was a journalist with the New York Times. I realized this must have sounded like a distinction without a difference to a liberal-hating Iowan, so I quickly dropped that I'm from Texas. "Your family still there?" he asked. "Yep, my family's still in Texas," I said. I often worked this into small talk while interviewing everydays in the intercoastal states. It was code for, "I'm not what you think I am. I shop at the Bass Pro Shop, too." He exhaled, apologized. We exchanged emails and waited for the police. He said he owned the bar that shared a parking lot with the Surf Ballroom and invited me for a drink on the house, which was just about the last thing I wanted to do after he nearly killed me and left me with an undrivable rental car in a town 90 miles from the nearest Avis. By the time I got inside the ballroom and arranged for a tow truck and a replacement car from Minneapolis, Hillary was taking the stage in front of a bulky American flag, and I was trying to confirm whether she'd eaten a wing. "I believe she did sample the wings," a press aide wrote. "But adding brown loafers, guy who can confirm all things wing-related." Brown loafers referred me to a photo on Twitter of Hillary holding a styrofoam plate of wings. "Does this mean she ate a couple?" I asked. No reply. Hillary proceeded to string together a miraculous series of American Pie puns. "As the song says, I can still remember how the music used to make me smile, and if you look around this room, all of you Democrats make me smile, too. It's clear we're ready to rock and roll." Then, after a summer spent answering, "What about your emails?" Hillary made a joke about the server. "You may have seen that I recently launched a Snapchat account. I love it, I love it," she said, wobbling her shoulders. "Those messages disappear all by themselves." "You can't joke about this stuff once the FBI is involved," Andrea Mitchell said on MSNBC. Her latest dilemma is not a joke to backers who see her front-running numbers in public opinion polls slipping, the Chicago Tribune wrote. USA Today ran an editorial titled, "Clinton Email Controversy is No Laughing Matter." Florida Senator Bill Nelson told the Associated Press, I don't think the campaign has handled it very well. I think the advice of her making a joke out of it, I think that was not good advice. Hillary was already having a bad summer. The email story wouldn't go away. She developed such an early and enduring aversion to us that the organizers of her speech on voting rights in Houston alerted the travelers in advance that there would be no opportunities to ask Hillary questions. The speech is the interview. Meanwhile, it seemed that everyone under 30 and in the entire borough of Brooklyn, where she'd leased an additional floor to make room for her expanding billion-dollar campaign, was feeling the burn. Even Hillary's close girlfriends describe her as mercurial. Each morning, aides would announce Hillary's mood as if it were the weather. Crabby with the chance of outburst. Hillary isn't one of those politicians who can turn it on with ease when the cameras flash. She wore her discomfort all over her face, but especially in Iowa. She'd been in a terrible mood when the campaign's digital team talked her into shooting a Vine video. After a brief shot of a Chillery Clinton beer koozie on an iced tea set up on the banks of the Cedar River, Hillary's irritated face filled the screen before she said with feigned goofiness, "I'm just chillin' in Cedar Rapids." The travelers must have watched the 5-second video at least 100 times, howling louder each time we saw her windswept face overtake the screen. "I'm just chillin' in Cedar Rapids. Just chillin' in Cedar Rapids." Months later, Ruby Kramer, the BuzzFeed reporter with whom I'd bonded after one of the guys spotted us in a sea of several hundred FOBs at a Clinton Library barbecue in Little Rock and threw us out mid-po' boy, and I would almost miss the motorcade when Hillary made a stop at Ray Gun, a hipster t-shirt store in Des Moines. We couldn't leave the store until we'd each bought a purple cotton t-shirt that said in white block letters, "I'm just chillin' here in Cedar Rapids." In August, Maureen Dow, the New York Times columnist and the loveliest thorn in Hillary's side, published her "Joe Biden in 2016, What Would Beau Do?" column, revealing that Joe Biden's dying son had urged him to run for president. I'd separately heard from Democrats and donors that Biden was seriously considering making a late entry into the race. I had a news story in the works about Biden taking steps to run. My editor, Carolyn, lit up over the potential scoop and the ensuing capital T tension of Biden shaking up what looked like a Hillary coronation. Carolyn had this way of making all reporters desperate to please her, or as my colleague Michael Barbaro put it, "You gotta make mama happy." There was nothing like the warmth of Carolyn's sun when it shined on you, her single roar of a laugh that cut through any conversation, her inquisitive eyes bursting out of their sockets upon hearing about a juicy story, the praise she heaped on her reporters when they delivered something awesome. But when she went dark, casting her light on another colleague or hardly looking away from her screen in disappointment that we hadn't brought her that killer quote or nailed that delicious detail, life could be a cold, desperate place. I wanted to make Mama happy, even if it meant the guys would destroy me for it. I'd begun not to care as much about what they thought, partly because of Carolyn's supernova support, but also because with the campaign in full swing, I had no shortage of stories to write and chatty sources informing me about the goings-on inside Brooklyn. I still wanted, more than anything, for Hillary to see me as a fair reporter. But the guy's threats about cutting off access had no coin, since I could have filled the Times with daily front-page stories about Hillary's altruistic work with women and girls, and she still wouldn't have given me or any beat reporter real access. I had nothing to lose. I heard that Biden had confided, off the record, to the White House press corps that he wanted to run, but added something like, "You guys don't understand these people. The Clintons will try to destroy me." I gathered nuggets on a draft Biden super PAC and some on-record quotes from donors, but the story was missing that final ingredient, confirmation from someone deep in the Veep's innermost circle. I was at LaGuardia awaiting a delayed flight to Miami to cover a Hillary speech on Cuban-American relations, a direct aim at Jeb, when a Biden insider tipped me off that something big was coming on Sunday. The only other clue he dropped was to ask Maureen. I fled LaGuardia and started making calls in the cab. Maureen and Biden go back to the 1988 campaign, and she knows his family and friends better than most. I didn't know what she had, but I knew it would be good. As soon as her column posted, my story went up, weaving in Maureen's scoop. Vice President Joseph R. Biden Jr. and his associates have begun to actively explore a possible presidential campaign, which would upend the Democratic field and deliver a direct threat to Hillary Rodham Clinton. It led the Sunday paper. Rather than seeing the op-ed, an A1 story for what they were, a trial balloon by the Biden camp, Hillary interpreted our Biden reporting as another Times smear. She sent the message to all her top aides. Joel Benenson must have bitched me out for an hour. Maureen got it worse, in terms that Brooklyn would have called sexist had they been directed at Hillary. What is wrong with this woman, Huma wrote when a press aide emailed Maureen's column around. Just when she'd seemed to quiet down, Robbie Mook replied. She is full of self-loathing, Jen Palmieri chimed in. The front-page article on Biden, which was written off of only Maureen Dowd's psychotic column, Podesta wrote about my story, they are worse than Roger Ailes. Days earlier, Podesta described getting fucked by the NYT about a story by the Times' Mike Schmidt and Matt Apuzzo that said the Justice Department had opened a criminal referral into Hillary's handling of sensitive information on her private server. Even our own colleague, John Harwood, a Times contributor and CNBC correspondent, couldn't resist piling on. I can't blame him. It's like Peter Fallow, the rumpled tabloid reporter in Bonfire of the Vanities, says, if you're gonna live in a whorehouse, there's only one thing you can do. Be the best damn whore around. Cannot believe Biden's story is leading the paper, Harwood wrote to Podesta. It strikes me that Biden is actively exploring is the new criminal referral of Hillary Clinton, if you know what I mean. The only hitch? Both of those stories turned out to be true. Hillary's contorting on issues like the Keystone XL pipeline and the Trans-Pacific Partnership that summer had nothing to do with Bernie and everything to do with Biden. If she could secure enough support from labor and lock up the black vote, the Veep would see he had no path. When Bernie called Pete D'Alessandro to see if he would run his Iowa operation, he didn't ask whether Pete thought he could win or how much it would cost to catch up with Hillary, who already had dozens of offices and hundreds of staffers spread across the state. Bernie asked only this. Do you understand my politics? I kept thinking about that question, do you understand my politics? I couldn't imagine Hillary asking anyone that, and if she had asked, even her closest aides would have spent a few minutes trying to come up with the answer they thought Hillary wanted to hear. I sympathized with Hillary. She maintained a consistent set of beliefs over the years, rooted in her Methodist faith and the social gospel. A progressive who likes to get things done was how, in an off-the-cuff moment, she defined her politics in the first Democratic debate. But after 4 decades in politics, she'd allowed the details to get so muddied that when she said every child deserves the chance to live up to his or her God-given potential, the words felt like such a safe political platitude that reporters joked she'd soon come out in favor of kittens and rainbows. But in those months of obsessing about Biden while trying to keep Obama happy, she'd been forced to become a magician's assistant, stuck in a box and twisting and turning to avoid the blades. She'd stood in a canary yellow blazer in the unair-conditioned gymnasium of the Amherst Street Elementary School and brushed off a question about whether she supported the Keystone XL pipeline. This is President Obama's decision, and I'm not going to second-guess him, she said. If it's undecided when I become president, I will answer your question. When that didn't quite do the trick, aides spent the next couple of months debating how Hillary could come out against the project without appearing to split with Obama. We are trying to find a good way to leak her opposition to the pipeline without her having to actually say it and give up her principled stand about not second-guessing the president in public, her chief speechwriter Dan Schwerin wrote to Cheryl Mills. By September, Hillary told a community forum in Des Moines that she opposed the pipeline. Then there was TPP, Obama's signature trade deal. At the State Department, she called it the gold standard of free, transparent, fair trade. But now that she needed organized labor to squeeze Biden out, Hillary decided TPP didn't meet her very high bar. Dan Schwerin said the goal of that tortured statement, as of today I'm not in favor of what I have learned about it, had been to minimize our vulnerability to the authenticity attack and not piss off the White House any more than necessary. Mandy Grunwald wrote back, "This is so full of compliments, I can barely tell that HRC is opposing the deal." Hillary wouldn't even take a firm stance on whether women should split the bill on a date. "Look, I think splitting the cost on a date has to be evaluated on a kind of case-by-case basis," she told Cosmo. "You know, many years ago, I remember doing that, and I know a lot of young people who even today do because they kind of consider more casual dates, group dates, to be ones where everybody pays their fair share. But I think you also have to be alert to the feelings of the person that you are dating." Chapter 16. The Ninnies. Brooklyn, 2015. Hillary told Age she'd stepped in it, and not just stepped in it, but dug a foot in and rested it there so long that the stink wouldn't wear off. She blamed her staff for the ill-advised joke at the wing ding. "I look forward to your feedback, and if anyone has a funny email server joke, please send it my way," Dan Schwerin had asked on an early draft. For me, the most disappointing result of the whole thing had nothing to do with the hyperventilating media or the FBI investigation or Hillary's truly miserable mood for the next several weeks. Rather, it was that after the wing ding, Hillary suffered from a chronic inability to crack a simple joke. Voters never got to see Hillary's funny, wicked, and wacky side, as Diane Blair had once described it. In private settings, which included closed press fundraisers and paid speeches to Wall Street banks, Hillary exhibited a dry, acerbic wit that didn't easily translate into lines made for mass consumption on the campaign trail. In a Q&A with Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein, Hillary related how, as Secretary of State, she'd argued with a Chinese diplomat that his country had no more right to claim the South China Sea than the United States had to the Pacific. "But they have to take New Jersey," Blankfein injected. "No, no," Hillary said, "we're going to give them a red state." But on the stump, Hillary would insert pop culture puns that stumbled off her tongue in unexpected, often painful ways. During the Pokemon Go craze, she told a crowd in Northern Virginia, "I don't know who created Pokemon Go, but I'm trying to figure out how we get them to Pokemon Go to the polls." At a Jennifer Lopez concert in Miami days before the election, Hillary burst onto the stage, gave J-Lo in her lace-up kimono and thigh-high boots a klutzy embrace, and exclaimed to the crowd, "Let's get loud at the voting booth!" The travelers lived for these brief glimpses of Hillary's wacky side, spending hours trying to anticipate her next election-related wordplay. The night she joined Jay-Z and Beyoncé on stage in Cleveland, "Okay, ladies, let's now get in formation and vote." Or what about, "I've got 99 problems and Hillary Clinton is going to fix every single one." After the wing ding, I understood Hillary's reflex to overthink every potential line that veered from the standard script. This, in turn, caused her already skittish aides to suck the life out of any attempt at unlitigated laughs. They fought over and rewrote jokes to the point of high parody until even the simplest punchline felt as heavy as a loaf of bread kneaded to an inch of its life by a dozen sets of overzealous hands. The back and forth went something like this. Ninny number one. "I agree with Joel. Let's not go back to the emails. What about, I used to be obsessed with Donald Trump's hair. That was until I got to spend 11 hours staring at the top of Trey Gowdy's head." Ninny number two. "I love the joke, too, but I think HRC should stay above the Benghazi committee, and especially above personal insults about it. She's got every inch of the high ground right now." Ninny number three. "Agree. Tempting, but she shouldn't go there tonight." Ninny number four. "Wow, you people are a bunch of ninnies." Ninny number five. "Not ninnies. We own the high ground right now. We should stay there." Ninny number six. "All that said, we really could use a little humor in here." Ninny number seven. "Is there some apprentice joke to make? I never saw the show. I'm also the worst person to generate jokes." Ninny number eight. "You all think WJC's joke is too much about her kind of wishing after hour eight that Bernie would come through the door with his damn emails line? I think it's funny and confident, and the room would love it." Ninny number five. "I think it gives Bernie the credit for putting the email crap behind us instead of her. She crushed the debate and she crushed at the committee." Ninny number one. "I defer if others think this buys us goodwill with Sanders people, but email jokes in Iowa usually end up badly, and don't we want to move on?" Chapter 17, A Tale of Two Choppers. Once a traveler leaves his home, he loses almost 100% of his ability to control his environment. Agent Dale Cooper, Twin Peaks, 4:28 a.m. from the Great Northern Hotel. Des Moines, August, 2015. By the time I filed my story in a police report, had my car towed, got a replacement car brought from Minneapolis to Clear Lake, and drove to Des Moines after the wing ding, the Hilton Garden Inn had given away my room. The crush of visitors for the Iowa State Fair put my prepaid, pre-confirmed suite in high demand, the late-night front desk manager explained. He handed me a voucher for the Hotel Fort Des Moines. The Hotel Fort Des Moines? Isn't that place condemned? It's going through some renovations, he said. The historic hotel, built in 1919, was taller than most buildings in downtown Des Moines, erected in a red brick H-shape and framed with creepy Gothic cornices. Back in 2008, in the 10th floor presidential suite, Bill had had an apoplectic fit as the caucus results rolled in. The Clintons stayed there because it's a union hotel and they got to take over the entire penthouse floor, but it was a dump even then. There was no way Hillary or anyone who could cough up the $108 a night on the newly built Hampton Inn would choose to stay at the Fort Des Moines. Brown Loafer's guy, who had worked on the advance team that set up folding chairs and hung up American flags at Hillary's Iowa town halls during the 2008 campaign, mimed dry-heaving when I told him I spent the night there. But I was exhausted, and at that hour it was either the Fort Des Moines or my car. The tawny, wood-lined lobby smelled of mothballs. The woman at the front desk warned me that the air conditioning was broken and all the windows were barred closed on account of the renovation. She handed me a plastic fan that I tucked under my arm, its cord dragging behind me. I carried my bucket to the ice machine down the smoky hallway, only to find it was bone dry. I wet towels with cold water and slept naked on them. The next morning, I took a cold shower and was out the door by 7 to chase Hillary and Trump around the Iowa State Fair. The annual gathering draws 1 million visitors who descend on the fairgrounds for carnival rides, concerts, and the chance to talk to presidential candidates as they eat deep-fried nachos and cheese curds and 75 different varieties of food impaled on a stick. The wrong culinary move can spell calamity. In 2003, not long after John Kerry, already seen as effete, had asked for Swiss on his Philly cheesesteak instead of the usual cheese whiz topping, his press secretary, Robert Gibbs, spotted Kerry ordering a strawberry smoothie. He sent an all-staff email out to the campaign. Somebody get a fucking corn dog in his hand now! Hillary wore a gingham blouse and stood in front of a couple slobbery brown cows to take questions from the press. This included several, what about your emails, questions. It's not anything people talk to me about as I travel around the country, she said. And multiple inquiries about whether Tom Harkin, the lovable liberal titan who didn't endorse in 2008, had endorsed Hillary 6 months before the caucuses to scare off Biden. My support for Hillary for president has nothing to do with other people, he said, following Brooklyn's instructions not to utter the Veep's name. But we knew the answer. Everything Brooklyn did the entire month of August and into September was designed to squeeze out the Veep. The press was mostly huddled under shade trees, many of us still smelling like the men's locker room at a 24-hour fitness. But Hillary stood fully exposed under the beating sun and didn't even glisten. It was one of her many gifts. She never sweat. I asked a close aide about this once, who told me Hillary had built up a tolerance over all those years of accompanying Bill to outdoor events in Arkansas. Arkansas got hot, Texas hot, but there was no way going to the Mount Nebo Chicken Fry, the Smackover Oil Town Festival, and the Bradley County Pink Tomato Festival somehow bestowed on the governor's wife the supernatural ability not to perspire 3 decades later in August in the Midwestern humidity. I ran all this by a Times colleague's partner who is a dermatologist. He had another theory. Botox, he said. You get injections into your glands, and just like that, no more sweat. Under all the niceties, Iowans can be a smug, demanding bunch. They wanted Hillary to show them she could do the glad-handing retail politicking she'd failed to do in 2008. She barreled through the fairgrounds accompanied by her usual blob, a slow-moving, cumbersome cluster of campaign staff, Secret Service agents wearing bodyguard casual polo shirts, at least one senator, a former governor, several prominent donors with questionable income streams, and her entire traveling press corps, at least 50 of us. "I'm just having a good time," Hillary said. "What did she say? We couldn't hear a word," yelled a woman wearing an H button. I tried to get ahead of the blob, skipping in front of Hillary and her entourage as she made her way through the agriculture building, past the prize-winning yellow hybrid popcorn and the display of onions and the life-size cow made entirely of butter. As she wove through the predetermined route that aides and security had mapped out for her, Hillary posed for 42 pictures, raved about being a grandmother. "It's the best!" Examined a Monopoly-themed sculpture also made of butter. "I love it!" Asked if Iowa had any zoning programs to help out small farmers, it does, and gave an evasive, "sounds good," to a fairgoer who asked if she would attend a tailgate party sponsored by the Iowa Corn Growers Association. I was pretending to peruse a walkthrough display on genetically engineered corn when the blob made its way inside. I ran right into Huma, who looked like she'd gotten lost in the Barney's shoe department. "Oh, look, there's Amy," she said with her usual enthusiasm. "Oh, hi," Hillary said, and then turned to the corn growers. She nodded. A lot of Americans don't appreciate how innovative and forward-looking the country's farmers are. After ordering the requisite pork chop on a stick and taking a couple of bites, Hillary climbed into the back seat of a black SUV, leaving Iowans and the blob behind to fly on a private plane to Martha's Vineyard for Vernon Jordan's 80th birthday party. Def Leppard was performing at the fair that night, and I passed a couple fairgoers humming the grainy guitar solo of "Pour Some Sugar on Me" as I strained to see Trump's helicopter and a 1,235-pound pumpkin in the distance. The helicopter said everything about the double standard Hillary would face in 2016. Back in 2007, the landing skids of the Bell 222 had hardly touched down on her 99-county, 5-day blitz on the helicopter, before the press said Hillary's chartered chopper was the ultimate symbol of her inept campaign and her own out-of-touch elitism. "A pickup truck might have been a little more effective," sniped David Nagel, a Democratic congressman and Cedar Falls attorney. "Hillary Clinton couldn't buy Iowans' love," a Washington Post headline read. I used the helicopter in my stories, too, saying Iowans had cringed at the loud landing of the helicopter, which cost several thousand dollars a day in a state where voters prefer their candidates in greyhounds. There is a photo of us from that December morning in 2007. We are in Elkader, about to step onto the red carpet laid across the ice-covered tarmac to board the helicopter for the inaugural one-and-a-half-hour flight to Waterloo. I can still see Hillary step out of her van with her hands in her pockets. I introduce myself and tell her I'll be covering her campaign that we first met 10 years earlier when she was in San Antonio. She pretends to remember. Hillary is wearing her black shearling-lined leather coat, the one that screams 1993 but that she'll never get rid of. I am just back from Tokyo and my hair is still a chemically streaked mass of bleached waves. I am carrying a reporter's notebook and a brown leather satchel that I splurged on before I left for Iowa because, even though it is heavy and digging into my shoulder, it looks like something a campaign reporter would carry. My hair is spread all over her shoulder like some yellow sea creature's tentacles. We are so cold that she has dropped the politician look. She could be an aunt or one of my mother's friends. Cynthia McFadden, the ABC News anchor, yells from a distance, "What prepared you for this, Senator?" Hillary replies, "I wanted to be an astronaut when I was a little girl." That's when outsider guy, who years later would tell me that no one took me seriously, snaps the picture. Hillary and I are pulled in close, shoulder to shoulder, without a hint of bitterness between us. Now when I look at that photo, I realize that damn chopper hulking behind our warmest moment was an omen. I couldn't get over how 7 years later, when Trump gave about 50 kids rides on his customized Sikorsky S-76B at the Iowa State Fair, the political class marveled at the helicopter as evidence of his marketing genius. The Trump copter became indicative of his connection to the people. He was the everyman's, or the everyday's, billionaire. He told one little boy, "I am Batman," a comment we all found hilarious before realizing we were living in the dark night. One of six CNN stories about the chopper rides read, "Donald Trump's helicopter provides a thrill for children at the Iowa State Fair." The Bloomberg Politics headline read, "Mark Halperin rides in style with the Donald." ABC News' Martha Raddatz also hopped on board. "The kids love it," Trump said over the engine's hum. It wasn't only that a candidate had to have a penis to pull off the helicopter stunt, though that helped. It was something else, something about Trump and the press and how amusing we found all of it. Trump stepped off a golf cart in a dark blue blazer, his